Before Lady Gaga, before Elton John, there was Liberace. People of a certain age will remember the candelabra on his piano, the flamboyant costumes, even the self-deprecating humor in his distinctive voice.
My clothes may look funny, but they're making me the money.
At one point, thanks to performing in Las Vegas, Liberace was the highest paid entertainer in the world. And he created a museum that bears his name, which was once among the most visited attractions in Vegas. Those days are gone, and so few people visit the Liberace Museum. It's closing on Sunday. NPR's Ted Robbins hurried over before it was too late.
Maybe this is just one more story about how Vegas is constantly changing. But maybe not. After all, Sinatra is still Sinatra. Elvis still has impersonators performing here. So what happened to Liberace? Marion Blank saw him decades ago, and she still remembers his charisma, personality, and showmanship.
It was really a spectacular show. He came on in a car and all glitzed up as he usually is. And it was just a wonderful experience.
She came from Indiana for one last visit to the Liberace Museum to see the outrageous costumes, like a black mink cape lined with 40,000 Swarovski crystals, the over-the-top cars, including a Rolls-Royce covered in little mirrors, and the piano collection featuring a mirror-encrusted Baldwin Grand. That's a recording of Liberace playing the Baldwin. He was classically trained, but Liberace wanted to please the masses. He said he played classical without the boring parts. Classipop, museum archivist Jerry Goldberg calls it. It made Liberace famous.
But the biggest problem was you didn't leave humming or singing his music because he played other people's music. His name more or less has died out because there's nothing to associate him with except the bling and showmanship.
His biggest fans were middle-aged women in the 1950s through the 1970s, a shrinking demographic. Liberace might have become a gay icon, Goldberg says. Lots of people, including his own mother, knew Liberace was gay.
A lot of people knew. His mother was aware of his lifestyle, but back then it would have been a catastrophe for his career. So he never admitted it, even up to the day he died. Never came out of the closet.
But the biggest problem for the Liberace Museum may be its location. It's more than 2 miles off the Vegas Strip, and visitors just don't want to make the trip. Though now that it's closing, locals like Katie Driscoll are coming.
My mother watched Liberace all the time when I was growing up and played the piano, and so did I. And I moved here, became a showgirl, and heard that it was closing, and I didn't want to miss it.
Then there's Philip Balian. When he heard the Liberace Museum was closing, he got on a plane to Vegas from London.
I watched him as a child on television and saw him play, and I said to my parents, I'd like to learn to play the piano. I want to be like that guy there with the sparkly jacket.
Philip Balian learned to play the piano. No sparkly jacket, but now on his first trip to the States, he is thrilled that the museum staff let him play Liberace's mirror-encrusted grand piano for the final visitors. After Sunday, the piano and the other artifacts here will go into storage, and Liberace's fame will fade a little further. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Las Vegas.
The actor James Franco is setting a new standard for what it means to be eclectic in Hollywood. In his latest film, Howl, Franco slips into the character of beatnik poet Allen Ginsberg.
What is the Beat Generation?
There's no Beat Generation. Just a bunch of guys trying to get published.
As Jesse Baker reports, being a movie star is only one of the passions James Franco pursues obsessively.
James Franco has a hard time defining exactly what he does for a living.
I still get paid the most for acting, but the past 4 or 5 years I've been putting a lot more energy into other parts of my life.
Not just a few other parts of his life. He's writing short stories and reinventing poems.
You know, poems usually aren't turned into films, but I've done that a few times now.
He's modeling.
Gucci by Gucci.
He's playing a guy named Franco on the soap opera General Hospital.
So many women, so little time.
He's calling that performance art. Oh, yeah. He's also painting and setting up art exhibits on both coasts. And just in time for Oscar season, he's starring in Danny Boyle's next big thing after Slumdog Millionaire.
So the guidebook says that the route's through here, but I know a better way.
It's called 127 Hours. It's a true story about a hiker who gets trapped by a boulder in Robber's Roost, Utah. Franco's multifaceted artistic endeavors have become a running joke, even for the actor himself.
Could you bring out the bin?
This is his opening monologue from Saturday Night Live last December.
This bin is filled with idea slips that people give me throughout the year when I ask them for career advice. Every year I pick a few idea slips and then do whatever they say.
It would not be entirely shocking if James Franco did indeed take his career advice from a giant suggestion box. But the truth is, he's either a dabbling dilettante, an artist still searching for his medium, or James Franco is a freak. Which seems kind of appropriate. He got his start on TV in 1999, playing a high school freak.
Oh man, you want to hear something way messed up? You know that Molly Hatchet shirt I was wearing the other day? You know the one with the executioner guy holding that bloody axe?
Writer and director Judd Apatow cast James Franco for the Fox TV series Freaks and Geeks. He says on the set, Franco had a million crazy ideas.
If we were shooting a scene, he would say, I think I'm eating sunflower seeds in this scene. Or in another scene, he wanted to eat a snowball, those giant, disgusting Hostess cakes. So we'd say, James, so every single take you're going to eat an entire snowball? Because we might do this like 20 times. Yeah, I want to eat a snowball. I want to eat a snowball.
Hostess cakes aside, Apatow says Franco was the only actor who asked to shadow the show's director, and who then spent a week watching an episode be cut together. His fellow cast members, however, suspected he might be a bit of a poser.
In between takes, he would read Moby Dick, and no one knew if he was actually reading it or if it was just some sort of showing off.
James Franco went from reading Melville to studying obscure philosophers as an undergrad at UCLA. Professor Ken Reinhart had Franco in 2008 in his senior seminar on political theology.
He wanted to know all about these very, very recent hot theorists, people like Slavoj Žižek and Hélène Bédieu.
After graduating from UCLA with a degree in English, in true Franco fashion, the actor enrolled in 4 master's programs. And this fall, he starts work on a PhD at Yale.
You know, I've always been interested in art, literature, and film and acting. So I guess in the past 4 years, you know, I thought, why not just pursue them all seriously? See how, if they can all come together and how.
Aligning his passion is exactly what his latest project, Howl, does. In the film, Franco's portrait of Allen Ginsberg is a case study of a poet Franco says he's admired since he was a teenager. This is the poet himself.
I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all together singing the final stanzas of the Internationale.
Franco mirrors Ginsberg so closely. Listen.
I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all together singing the final stanzas of the Internationale.
Franco's wide-ranging artistic quest for enlightenment has severely confounded his fans. Is he an artist who moonlights as a movie star? Is he a scholar? A poet? Is he just confused? What are we supposed to make of this guy? Again, director Judd Apatow.
Someone who does all of this, it's very easy to look for the crack. What's wrong with him? What is he doing? It's got to be something demented in all of this.
We don't want to know what's going on inside James Franco's head, Apatow says, because what if James Franco is just a nice guy with more on his mind than a 7-figure paycheck? For NPR News, I'm Jesse Baker.
And now to another spy story, this one from the small screen. Will Travers solves puzzles. He sees patterns that most people never knew existed. That's what makes him good at his job. Travers is an intelligence analyst at the heart of the television series Rubicon. It's a show that critics have praised for its tension and intrigue and looming paranoia. In this clip, Travers is showing his boss hidden clues he's discovered in the crossword puzzles of various newspapers.
5 down. What do lucky lepidopter larvae eat? Answer, Marsilia quadrifolia.
Which is?
4-leaf clover. Our 3 branches of government are here. Legislative, executive, judicial. What or who does that 4th leaf represent? And what's the message?
Rubicon airs on AMC, and it wraps up its first season tomorrow night. With me is Henry Brummel. He's the show's executive producer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
For those who haven't seen the show yet, tell me about Will Travers' job. He works at this place called the American Policy Institute. What is it? What goes on there?
It's a sort of off-the-grid intelligence analyst office in New York City.
Sort of masking as a think tank.
Yeah, exactly, as a research center. And hopefully they're some of the best and the brightest and come up with information and patterns that tell them a story that can help us defend ourselves.
So the main storyline is that Will Travers notices that all of these people who also work in this field in intelligence start to die after a coded message is delivered in a crossword puzzle. He sort of spends the series trying to get to the bottom of this conspiracy. The story unfolds pretty slowly. We get, you know, as viewers, we get clues in this kind of trickle, but it's still pretty gripping stuff. How important was the pacing of the series to you?
Very important. The whole show is rooted in the feel and the look and the pacing of early 70s American filmmaking, specifically some of the sort of paranoid political thrillers of the time, like 3 Days of the Condor and The Parallax View. What we want to do is not have it be a ride in an amusement park, but something closer to what it's like for the person, in this case Will Travers, trying to unravel the puzzle, which is slow and deliberative and a lot of little, you know, sort of false alleys and finally getting to what he wants to know.
I read that your dad was a spy, that you actually grew up with a spy in your family. How did that affect the way you approach this series? Because obviously it's all about spies. I mean, you didn't grow up living in the U.S. at times, right?
No, we grew up all over the world. God knows what he was doing, but we were with him. But he was in the operations side for about almost 30 years. And when we were, you know, first sort of devising this show and came up with the idea of it being about analysts, I have to admit there was a little string that went ding inside me because, I'm pretty fascinated by it. I think it's, you know, you have a father who was silent by nature, who found a job in which he didn't have to actually ever talk about what he did. So maybe he found his perfect job. But for a kid like myself, it just made it all the more imperative that I figure out what he was doing.
The whole show is set against the backdrop of post-9/11 American paranoia, basically, right?
Yes.
And as you know, there are still quite a few people in this country and even around the world. I mean, notably, Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job, that it was a government conspiracy. Do you ever worry that your show kind of feeds into some of that?
Yeah, I do. I was talking with friends the other night, some journalist friends, about this and about how in the early 70s filmmaking that we sort of our hearts go back to, the paranoia was basically coming from one side of the political spectrum, the left, or what constitutes the left in the United States. You know, in reaction to Nixon, of Watergate, of being lied to by the government top to bottom. And now we find ourselves in the very strange position of the paranoia coming from the right side of the spectrum. I mean, Thomas Pynchon beautifully said in, I think, V, that what we got when we lost religion as a unifying glue in our culture was paranoia. Because we have to have something that suggests there are secret workings going on. And he may be right, you know, that it's less terrifying to look out into the world and see conspiracy, no matter how kooky it sounds, than to look out in the world and see nothing.
That's Henry Brummel. He's the executive producer of AMC's Rubicon. The final episode of Season 1 airs tomorrow night. Henry Brummel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Rubicon is a textbook example of how the balance of power is shifting in Hollywood. That's what Edward J. Epstein says. He's the author of The Hollywood Economist. And in a recent column at his website, he argued that television is now much more interesting than film, and there's a sound economic reason behind that. But it's a big change from when he was a kid.
When I was young, my parents forbid me to watch, you know, the boob tube because television was considered such a de-intellectualizing experience. We've had a role reversal. Now people go to cable television to watch programs like Mad Men and Boardwalk Empire and Damages, and they go to movies to see comic books. Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, Avatar.
Why do you think this is happening?
Well, this role reversal has happened because of the changing economics of both television and of the movie business. The movie business is basically driven by marketing departments that have only one audience that they can guarantee to turn out on Friday and Saturday nights. And that audience is teenagers and youth. Television, on the other hand, especially paid television, runs on a completely different business model. They have to stop people from canceling their subscription. So they have to reach the head of the household who pays the bills. And the only thing they can really offer is original programming. So they have basically put more and more money into original programming to keep the adult audience paying the bill.
And HBO, you say, sort of led this revolution. But here's a question. I mean, HBO spends millions and millions of dollars on original programming. Do they make money off of them?
Absolutely. They don't have to make money off an individual program. They get paid by the total number of subscribers.
So this idea that HBO is producing programs like The Wire to make good art isn't actually entirely true. It's more about making sure that people don't drop their subscriptions.
Well, I would even say it's the opposite, because a top HBO executive told me that they would rather have a program that had very low viewership but very high critical acclaim, especially in New York Times and elite media, because when people read those kind of stories about The Sopranos or The Wire, their reaction is, we cannot give this up.
Do you think that this is where entertainment is headed? That basically the quality programming is going to be on television and the lower quality is going to be in the cinemas?
Well, we have two kinds of cinema. One is what Hollywood produces, which opens in the multiplexes on 4,000 screens. The other, independent movies called platform opening, which open in a couple hundred screens. Independent movies will always be high quality and always serve a niche audience. If we're talking about mass entertainment, I think, yes, the quality is going to be found more and more on television and less in the movies.
That's Edward J. Epstein. His latest book is called The Hollywood Economist, The Hidden Financial Reality Behind the Movies. Edward, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's been a real pleasure being on your program.